Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. So we've been going through Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, a New York Times number one bestseller from 2004. What it does is go into a very deep foundational level for why we're in the kind of debt we are individually, nationally, and globally. So first, let's define this. And this is a quote from John Perkins. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an EHM. End quote. Again, that's John Perkins. And I will continue where I left off in the last show from Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which I highly recommend that you read. Maine was a macho corporation. There were only four women who held professional positions in 1971. However, there were perhaps 200 women divided between the cadres of personal secretaries. Every vice president and department manager had one, and the steno pool, which served the rest of the men. John had become accustomed to this gender bias, and he was therefore especially astounded by what happened one day in the BPL's reference section. An attractive brunette woman came up and sat in a chair across the table from him. In her dark green business suit, she looked very sophisticated. He judged her to be several years his senior, and he tried to focus on not noticing her, on acting indifferent. After a few minutes, without a word, she slid an open book in his direction. It contained a table with information he had been searching for about Kuwait, and a card with her name, Claudine Martin, and her title, Special Consultant to Chase TM Inc., which of course is his employer. He looked up into her soft green eyes, and she extended her hand. "I've been asking to help in your training," she said. He could not believe this was happening to him. Beginning the next day, they met in Claudine's Beacon Street apartment, a few blocks from Maine's Prudential Center headquarters. During their first hour together, she explained that his position was an unusual one and that they needed to keep everything highly confidential. She told him that no one had given him specifics about his job because no one was authorized to, except her. Then she informed him that her assignment was to mold him into an economic hitman. The very name awakened old cloak and dagger dreams. He was embarrassed by the nervous laughter he heard coming from himself. She smiled and assured him that humor was one of the reasons they used the term. "Who would take it seriously?" she asked. John confessed ignorance about the role of economic hitmen. "You're not alone," she laughed. "We're a rare breed in a dirty business. No one can know about your involvement, not even your wife." Then she turned serious. I'll be very frank with you, teach you all I can during the next weeks. Then you'll have to choose. Your decision is final. Once you're in for life. After that, she seldom used the full name. They were simply EHMs. John now knows what he did not then, that Claudine took full advantage of the personality weaknesses the NSA profile had disclosed about him, that is, the National Security Agency. He did not know who supplied her with the information, Einar, the NSA, Maine's personnel department, or someone else, only that she used it masterfully. Her approach, a combination of physical seduction and verbal manipulation, was tailored specifically for him, and yet it fit within the standard operating procedures he had since seen used by a variety of businesses when the stakes are high and the pressure to close lucrative deals is great. She knew from the start that he would not jeopardize his marriage by disclosing their clandestine activities. And she was brutally frank when it came to describing the shadowy side of things that would be expected of him. John had no idea who paid her salary, although he had no reason to suspect it was not, as her business card implied, Maine. At the time, he was too naive, intimidated, and bedazzled to ask the questions that today seem so obvious. Claudine told him that there were two primary objectives of his work. First, he was to justify huge international loans that would funnel money back to Maine and other U.S. companies such as Bechtel, Halliburton, Stone & Webster, and Brown & Root, through massive engineering and construction projects. Second, he would work to bankrupt the countries that received those loans, after they had paid Maine and the other U.S. contractors, of course, so that they would be forever beholden to their creditors, and so they would present easy targets when favors were needed, including military bases, UN votes, or access to oil and other natural resources. John's job, she said, was to forecast the effects of investing billions of dollars in a country. Specifically, he would produce studies that projected economic growth 20 to 25 years into the future and that evaluated the impacts of a variety of projects. For example, if a decision was made to lend a country $1 billion to persuade its leaders not to align with the Soviet Union, he would compare the benefits of investing that money in power plants with the benefits of investing in a new national railroad network or telecommunications system. Or he would be told that the country was being offered the opportunity to receive a modern electric utility system, and it would be up to him to demonstrate that such a system would result in sufficient economic growth to justify the loan. The critical factor in every case was gross national product. The project that resulted in the highest average annual growth of GNP won. If only one project was under consideration, he would need to demonstrate that developing it would bring superior benefits to the GNP. The unspoken aspect of every one of these projects was that they were intended to create large profits for the contractors and to make a handful of wealthy and influential families in the receiving countries very happy, while assuring the long-term financial dependence and therefore the political loyalty of governments around the world. The larger the loan, the better. The fact that the debt burden placed on a country would deprive its poor citizens of health, education, and other social services for decades to come was not taken into consideration. Claudine and John openly discussed the deceptive nature of GNP. For instance, the growth of GNP may result even when it profits only one person, such as an individual who owns a utility company, and even if the majority of the population is burdened with debt. The rich get richer and the poor grow poorer, yet from a statistical standpoint, that is recorded as economic progress. Like U.S. citizens in general, most Maine employees believed they were doing countries favors when they built power plants, highways, and ports. Schools and press have taught us to perceive all of actions as altruistic. Over the years, he repeatedly heard comments like, if they're going to burn the U.S. flag and demonstrate against our embassy, why don't we just get out of their damn country and let them wallow in their own poverty? And I'll return in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. People who say such things often hold diplomas certifying that they are well-educated. However, these people have no clue that the main reason we establish embassies around the world is to serve our own interests, which during the last half of the 20th century meant turning the American Republic into a global empire. Despite credentials, such people are as uneducated as those 18th century colonists who believed that the Indians fighting to defend their land were servants of the devil. Within several months, John would leave for the island of Java in the country of Indonesia, described at that time as the most heavily populated piece of real estate on the planet. Indonesia also happened to be an oil-rich Muslim nation and a hotbed of communist activity. It's the next domino after Vietnam, is the way Claudine put it. We must win the Indonesians over. If they join the communist bloc, well... She drew a finger across her throat and then smiled sweetly. Let's just say you need to come up with a very optimistic forecast of the economy, how it will mushroom after all the new power plants and distribution lines are built that will allow USAID and the international banks to justify the loans. You'll be rewarded, of course, and can move on to other projects in exotic places. The world is your shopping cart. Claudine went on to warn him that his role would be tough. Experts at the banks will come after you. It's their job to punch holes in your forecasts. That's what they're paid to do. Making you look bad makes them look good. One day, he reminded Claudine that the main team being sent to Java included 10 other men. He asked if they all were receiving the same type of training as himself. She assured him they were not. They're engineers, she said. They design power plants, transmission and distribution lines, and seaports and roads to bring in the fuel. You're the one who predicts the future. Your forecasts determine the magnitude of the systems they design and the size of the loans. You see, you're the key. Every time John walked away from Claudine's apartment, he wondered whether he was doing the right thing. Somewhere in his heart, he suspected he was not. But the frustrations of his past haunted him. Maine seemed to offer everything his life had lacked, and yet he kept asking himself if Tom Paine would have approved. In the end, he convinced himself that by learning more, by experiencing it, he could better expose it later, the old working from the inside justification. When he shared this idea with Claudine, she gave him a perplexed look. Don't be ridiculous. Once you're in, you can never get out. You must decide for yourself before you get in any deeper. He understood her, and what she said frightened him. After he left, he strolled down Commonwealth Avenue, turned into Dartmouth Street, and assured himself that he was the exception. One afternoon, some months later, Claudine and he sat in a window settee watching the snow falling on Beacon Street. We're a small, exclusive club, she said. We're paid, well paid, to cheat countries around the globe out of billions of dollars. A large part of your job is to encourage world leaders to become part of a vast network that promotes U.S. commercial interests. In the end, those leaders become ensnared in a web of debt that ensures their loyalty. We can draw on them whenever we desire, to satisfy our political, economic, or military needs. In turn, these leaders bolster their political positions by bringing industrial parks, power plants, and airports to their people. Meanwhile, the owners of U.S. engineering and construction companies become very wealthy. That afternoon, in the idyllic setting of Claudine's apartment, relaxing in the window while snow swirled around outside, he learned the history of the profession he was about to enter. Claudine described how, throughout most of history, empires were built largely through military force or the threat of it. But by the end of World War II, the emergence of the Soviet Union and the specter of nuclear holocaust, the military solution became just too risky. The decisive moment occurred in 1951 when Iran rebelled against a British oil company that was exploiting Iranian natural resources and its people. The company was the forerunner of British Petroleum, today's BP. In response, the highly popular, democratically elected Iranian Prime Minister and Time magazine's Man of the Year in 1951, Mohammad Mossadegh, nationalized all Iranian petroleum assets. An outraged England sought the help of her World War II ally, the United States. However, both countries feared that military retaliation would provoke the Soviet Union into taking action on behalf of Iran. Instead of sending in the Marines, Washington dispatched CIA agent Kermit Roosevelt, Theodore's grandson. He performed brilliantly, winning people over through payoffs and threats. He then enlisted them to organize a series of street riots and violent demonstrations, which created the impression that Mossadegh was both unpopular and inept. In the end, Mossadegh went down, and he spent the rest of his life under house arrest. The pro-American Mohammad Reza Shah became the unchallenged dictator. Kermit Roosevelt had set the stage for a new profession, the one whose ranks John was joining. Roosevelt's gambit reshaped Middle Eastern history, even as it rendered obsolete all the old strategies for empire building. It also coincided with the beginning of experiments in limited non-nuclear military action, which ultimately resulted in U.S. humiliations in Korea and Vietnam. By 1968, the year John interviewed with NSA, it had become clear that if the United States wanted to realize its dreams of global empire, as envisioned by men like Presidents Johnson and Nixon, it would have to employ strategies modeled on Roosevelt's Iranian example. This was the only way to beat the Soviets without the threat of nuclear war. There was one problem, however. Kermit Roosevelt was a CIA employee. Had he been caught, the consequences would have been dire. He had orchestrated the first U.S. operation to overthrow a foreign government, and it was likely that many more would follow. But it was important to find an approach that would not directly implicate Washington. Fortunately for the strategists, the 1960s also witnessed another type of revolution. The empowerment of international corporations and of multinational organizations such as the World Bank and the IMF. The latter was financed primarily by the United States and our sister empire builders in Europe. A symbiotic relationship developed between governments, corporations, and multinational organizations. By the time John was enrolled in BU's business school, a solution to the Roosevelt as CIA agent problem had already been worked out. U.S. intelligence agencies, including the NSA, would identify prospective EHMs who could then be hired by international corporations. These EHMs would never be paid by the government. Instead, they would draw their salaries from the private sector. As a result, their dirty work, if exposed, would be chalked up to corporate greed rather than to government policy. In addition, the corporations that hired them, although paid by government agencies and their multinational banking counterparts with taxpayer money, would be insulated from congressional oversight and public scrutiny, shielded by a growing body of legal initiatives, including trademark, international trade, and freedom of information laws. So you see, Claudine concluded, we are just the next generation in a proud tradition that began back when you were in first grade. And I'll return to this in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. In addition to learning about his new career, John also spent time reading books about Indonesia. The more you know about a country before you get there, the easier your job will be, Claudine had advised. He took her words to heart. When Columbus set sail in 1492, he was trying to reach Indonesia, known at that time as the Spice Islands. Throughout the colonial era, it was considered a treasure worth far more than the Americas. Java, with its rich fabrics, fabled spices, and opulent kingdoms, was both the crown jewel and the scene of violent clashes between Spanish, Dutch, Portuguese, and British adventurers. The Netherlands emerged triumphant in 1750, but even though the Dutch controlled Java, it took them more than 150 years to subdue the outer islands. When the Japanese invaded Indonesia during World War II, Dutch forces offered little resistance. As a result, Indonesians, especially the Javanese, suffered terribly. Following the Japanese surrender, a charismatic leader named Sukarno emerged to declare independence. 4 years of fighting finally ended on December 27, 1949, when the Netherlands lowered its flag and returned sovereignty to a people who had known nothing but struggle and domination for more than three centuries. Sukarno became the new republic's first president. Ruling Indonesia, however, proved to be a greater challenge than defeating the Dutch. Far from homogeneous, the archipelago of about 17,500 islands was a boiling pot of tribalism, divergent cultures, dozens of languages and dialects, and ethnic groups who nursed century-old animosities. Conflicts were frequent and brutal, and Sukarno clamped down. He suspended parliament in 1960 and was named president for life in 1963. He formed close alliances with communist governments around the world in exchange for military equipment and training. He sent Russian-armed Indonesian troops into neighboring Malaysia in an attempt to spread communism throughout Southeast Asia and win the approval of the world's socialist leaders. Opposition built, and a coup was launched in 1965. Sukarno escaped assassination only through the quick wits of his mistress. Many of his top military officers and his closest associates were less lucky. The events were reminiscent of those in Iran in 1953. In the end, the Communist Party was held responsible, especially those factions aligned with China. In the army-initiated massacres that followed, an estimated 300,000 to 500,000 people were killed. The head of the military, General Suharto, took over as president in 1968. By 1971, the United States' determination to seduce Indonesia away from communism was heightened because the outcome of the Vietnam War was looking very uncertain. President Nixon had begun a series of troop withdrawals in the summer of 1969, and U.S. strategy was taking on a more global perspective. The strategy focused on preventing a domino effect of one country after another filing under communist rule, and it focused on a couple of countries. Indonesia was the key. Maine's electrification project was part of the comprehensive plan to ensure American dominance in Southeast Asia. The premise of U.S. foreign policy was that Suharto would serve Washington in a manner similar to the Shah of Iran. The United States also hoped the nation would serve as a model for other countries in the region. Washington based part of its strategy on the assumption that gains made in Indonesia might have positive repercussions throughout the Islamic world, particularly in the explosive Middle East. And if that were not incentive enough, Indonesia had oil. No one was certain about the magnitude or quality of its reserves, but oil company seismologists were exuberant over the possibilities. As John pored over the books at the BPL, his excitement grew. He began to imagine the adventures ahead. In working for Maine, he would be trading the rugged Peace Corps lifestyle for a much more luxurious and glamorous one. His time with Claudine already represented the realization of one of his fantasies. It seemed too good to be true. He felt at least partially vindicated for serving the sentence at the all-boys prep school. Something else was also happening in his life. His wife, Anne, and he were not getting along. He thinks she must have sensed that he was leading two lives. He justified it as the logical result of the resentment he felt toward her for forcing them to get married in the first place. Never mind that she had nurtured and supported him through the challenges of their Peace Corps assignment in Ecuador, he still saw her as a continuation of his pattern of giving into his parents' whims. Of course, as he looks back on it, he's sure his relationship with Claudine was a major factor. He could not tell Anne about this, but she sensed it. In any case, they decided to move into separate apartments. One day in 1971, about a week before his scheduled departure for Indonesia, he arrived at Claudine's place to find the small dining room table set with an assortment of cheeses and breads, and there was a fine bottle of wine. She toasted him. "You've made it," she smiled, but somehow it seemed less than sincere. "You're now one of us." They chatted casually for half an hour or so. Then, as they were finishing off the wine, she gave him a look unlike any he had seen before. "Never admit to anyone about our meetings," she said in a stern voice. "I won't forgive you if you do, ever, and I'll deny I ever met you." She glared at him, perhaps the only time he felt threatened by her, and then gave a cold laugh. "Talking about us will make life dangerous for you." He was stunned. He felt terrible. But later, as he walked alone back to the Prudential Center, he had to admit to the cleverness of the scheme. The fact is that all their time together had been spent in her apartment. There was not a trace of evidence about their relationship, and no one at Maine was implicated in any way. There was also part of him that appreciated her honesty. She had not deceived him the way his parents had about Tilton and Middlebury. John had a romanticized vision of Indonesia, the country where he was to live for the next 3 months. Some of the books he read featured photographs of beautiful women in brightly colored sarongs, exotic Balinese dancers, shamans blowing fire, and warriors paddling along dugout canoes in emerald waters at the foot of smoking volcanoes. Particularly striking was a series of the magnificent black-sailed galleons of the infamous Bugis pirates, who still sailed the seas of the archipelago, and who had so terrorized early European sailors that they returned home to warn their children, "Behave yourselves, or the boogeyman will get you." Oh, how those pictures stirred John's soul. The history and legends of that country represent a cornucopia of larger-than-life figures, wrathful gods, Komodo dragons, tribal sultans, and ancient tales that long before the birth of Christ have traveled across Asian mountains, through Persian deserts, and over the Mediterranean to embed themselves in the deepest realms of our collective psyche. The very names of its fabled islands, Java, Sumatra, Borneo, Sulawesi, seduced the mind. Here was a land of mysticism, myth, and erotic beauty, an elusive treasure sought but never found by Columbus, a princess wooed yet never possessed by Spain, by Holland, by Portugal, by Japan, a fantasy and a dream. And we will continue in the next show. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.